This is Rabbi Jeff Sachs of Atid in the Web Yeshiva with our ongoing series, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik's Halachic Man. My apologies. Last week we had to cancel the class as technical difficulties kept me from logging onto the system for some reason that we still cannot explain. It's actually pretty remarkable. When we started Web Yeshiva in 2007, these things happen from time to time. Technical problems and things like that. But the system has been upgraded so much over the past number of years that it has literally been, I can't remember how long ago, years since a technical problem prevented me from teaching, but some little quirk in the system, a monkey wrench in the works, kept us last week. But here we are continuing in the second session in this series looking at Rabbi Soloveitchik's Halachic Man. Welcome to all of you online. There's this interesting little conversation going on in the chat room in which I think Russell in New Zealand is taunting all of us in the Northern Hemisphere about the nice weather down there. And those of you in North America have been suffering through the snow. And even here in Israel, it was cold and rainy today, but we're glad for that because it's been rather dry, despite all the snow that we had in December. It's been a very dry January, and that always causes us a great deal of anxiety. You know, we Jews, we get anxious about the weather because we think it is a sign of our relationship with God, and that's pretty interesting, don't you think? Halachic Man, here we are. We first rolled up our sleeves and started looking at Halachic Man after something of an introduction in the previous session, and we encountered the beginning of the introduction to these three personalities: cognitive man, who might be identified as the scientist; homo religiosus, the religious man, who is a man focused on the sublime, on the spiritual, on the transcendent, but not the highest form of religious personality, which is of course the synthesis of the two, known as the halachic man, the character that Rabbi Soloveitchik is setting out to explain here. Now, Rabbi Soloveitchik mentions in the very first footnote. Here you have the notes to the essay. Rabbi Soloveitchik mentions here in the very first footnote that the description of halachic man given here refers to a pure ideal type, as is the case with the other types with which the human sciences, and there's a German word, so Binechana, where are you? Make yourself useful. Or Yair Tzvi. Do one of you have a microphone? Binechana, there you go. Read the German for us.
Geisteswissenschaften.
Louder.
Geisteswissenschaften.
There you go. Which means?
Human sciences?
Human sciences. Okay. What we call in Hebrew, Madei HaRuach. Real halachic men who are not simple, but rather hybrid types. Meaning, it's like a science experiment. He's putting everything into the, what do you call that thing that divides everything up into its component parts? That spins everything around and separates everything into its component parts. The centrifuge. Thank you, Russell. In reality, reality is always more messy than that. Real halachic men, meaning halachic men that don't occupy this kind of platonic remove, the ideal, but in this world, the halachic men of flesh and blood are never quite so simple, never quite so pure, but they're hybrid types, approximate to a lesser or greater degree. The ideal halachic man, each in accordance with his spiritual image and stature. And then he mentions Edward Spranger. Spranger, well, here he is. Let's look at Spranger. There's Spranger. Spranger, who lived in, you know, worked at the, you know, the beginning and middle of the 20th century, was a social scientist and philosopher, And he wrote this important book called Type in English, it's called Types of Men. It's written, of course, in German. He develops this idea of typology, which was a philosophical strain that was of influence on Rabbi Soloveitchik. This idea that you could present abstract philosophical ideas as embodied, as exemplified by these pure typological type, meaning typological meaning the study of different types of characters. And I made passing reference to this last time, but this Spranger was you know, something of an influence, or his writings were something of an influence in the Rav and the Segura, the idea that we can present the man of faith, the lonely man of faith, the halachic man, the man of God, the character that stars in the Rav's work, Uvikashtem Misham, which is something of a sequel to Halachic Man, and then many other supporting characters in the canon of Rabbi Soloveitchik's writing, all of these different types of ideal types. Since we're talking philosophy, let's take another short detour. Because if typological thinking and the exposition of typological thought is evident here, there's another elephant in the room, and that's good old Immanuel. Immanuel Kant, the great 18th century philosopher, perhaps the most significant figure in modern philosophy, German philosopher Immanuel Kant. Kant is something of the founder of a school of philosophy called phenomenology. Kant writes a book called The Critique of Pure Reason. In English, it's called The Critique of Pure Reason. And Kant, I'm grossly oversimplifying this, but Kant says something like this. Philosophy, medieval philosophy, ancient philosophy, dealt with questions like proofs of the existence of God, trying to understand how God interacts with the world. Think of medieval Jewish philosophy. Think of the Rambam and the work in the Mishneh Torah. These were the things that occupied medieval philosophy. But modern philosophy, says Kant, cannot say anything about the metaphysical world. The physical world, the natural world, is the world we occupy, the world we live in. It happens to be the purview of cognitive man. The scientist lives in this physical world. The physical world which can be observed, which can be measured, which can be hypothesized about and experimented on. The metaphysical world, metaphysics meaning that which is beyond the physical realities we occupy, what sometimes is called, what we sometimes call philosophy, but of course in the medieval world and certainly in the ancient world, these realms, philosophy and physics, or philosophy and what we'll call the hard sciences, were much less clearly defined. And think about it, all those great medieval philosophers, the Rambam, the Ramban, and others, they were also medical doctors. And the idea that a philosopher and a scientist were the same thing, were working, you know, in the same field, which is a foreign notion to us today, was not the case way back then. And Kant says that philosophy cannot say anything about the metaphysical realm, the realm of the spirit, what we call the realm of religion, even though there is such a thing as philosophy of religion. All it can do is make a phenomenological analysis. Now, I mentioned this because I used the term last week, and one or two people asked about it. Thank you. Peter posts a link to Spranger's book, which apparently is Questia. And Steve asked a question about the footnotes. The footnotes are the Rav's footnotes. The Rav wrote these footnotes and the translator translated them. And in this case, I think I mentioned last time, the Rav worked with the translator, Lawrence Kaplan, in preparing the translation. So, and as a matter of fact, Kaplan wrote an interesting little essay about that experience of working with the Rav on the translation. I will try to send you that essay. I'm fairly certain it's available online. And it's worth reading. Any place that Kaplan adds something of his own, it appears in square brackets. It's clearly thus indicated. So Kant says all we can do as phenomenologists is to describe experiences, to describe phenomena. Phenomenology, the study of phenomena, to describe them as they are experienced. And to be honest, we can only really describe them as we individually experience them. I remind you of what the Rav said in the context of tefillah, quoting Cardinal Newman, that in the spiritual realm, egotism is true modesty, because all you can ever do is describe your own inner experiences. I mean, and we aspire to be self-aware enough that we can give an honest description of our own inner, private, subjective spiritual experiences. So to be able to make a statement about yourself, to be egocentric in that way is itself a form of modesty, because it's an admission that we only ever have a reference to our own experiences, never really to another person's own inner experiences. And that's part of what Kant is saying, that we can only ever describe things. So the Rav, to this degree, is also a phenomenologist. And these two things are somehow related, the typological school of Spranger and Kant's much earlier critique of pure reason and phenomenology, that we can only describe things as they are. And it's interesting. The Rav never makes an argument for why you should be a lonely man of faith or why you should be a halachic man. All he does is describe what this personality is like. And then You can aspire to be like him. You can model yourself after him. You can be possibly appalled by certain things in that personality. But he says at the end of the work, I'm going to give away something at the end. At the end of the work, the very final page of the essay, the Rav says, "Galui v'yadua lifnei misha barat olam." It's revealed and known before God that my sole intention in writing this work, my sole intention was to defend the honor of the halakha and halachic men, for both it and they have oftentimes been attacked by those who have not penetrated into the essence of halakha and have failed to understand the halachic personality. So he says, therefore, I'm giving this description of this pure type so that it should be more profoundly understood. And the degree to which this pure type, this halachic man, is this synthesis of these two discordant personalities, the scientist and the man of the spirit, the cognitive man and the homo religiosus, is in and of itself a defense of the halacha, is a defense of course, halacha here is a synonym for the authentic Jewish worldview. Because, and again, writing in early mid-century mid-20th century America, the view of the religious Jew was something that was, in his opinion, greatly misunderstood, misrepresented. The religious Jew was usually viewed as this kind of, you know, backward man of the spirit, downtrodden. Remember, this was an era when it was not a given that one could be Shomer Shabbat and maintain a job. And there were people who were Sabbath observant, but yet every week had to go to work and would get up early on Saturday morning to go to an early, early minyan before then having to take the trolley to go down to wherever it is that they worked, because that was the state of things at that point. And again, I think I made mention of this last week. If not, I've made mention of a number of times in other ways. That mid-century prediction that in a generation there would be no orthodoxy in the United States, which turned out to be a very, very, very inaccurate prediction, was nevertheless at that time where the safe money was. It seemed like a reasonable prediction, just from a purely objective social scientist prediction, not as taking a side on any team or in anything having to do with the denominational wars, but that's what it looked like. That's what the direction of orthodoxy looked like at that time. And the Rav was putting forth this image of an exalted man, a noble man, a man who both had the spirit of homo religiosus, but also had the mind of the scientist, and that the two together were greater than the sum of the parts. Let's return. We're on page 4 in the essay. We left off over here, that the contradictions, the antinomies, the tensions between those two characters, the scientist and the man of the spirit, emerges a radiant holy personality whose soul has been purified in the furnace of struggle and opposition and redeemed in the fires of the torments of spiritual disharmony to a degree unmatched by the universal homo religiosus. The deep split of the soul prior to its being united may, at times, raise a man to a rank of perfection, which for sheer brilliance and beauty is unequaled by any level attained by the simple, whose personality, by the simple whole personality, who has never been tried by the pangs of spiritual discord. Lefum tsara agra, according to the suffering is the reward, says the Mishnah in Avot. And in accordance with the split, the union, the tension between science and religion, between these two different types of personalities, between these two different worldviews, can be reconciled. But it is a reconciliation that comes about through strife. It is not a simple matter. This spiritual fusion that characterizes halachic man is distinguished by its consummate splendor. For did not the split touch the very depths, the innermost core of his being? There is much truth to the fundamental contention set forth both by the dialectical philosophies of Heraclitus and Hegel with regard to the ongoing course of existence in general and the views of Kierkegaard, Karl Barth, and Rudolf Otto with regard to religious consciousness and the embodiment the experience of homo religiosus, in particular, namely, that there is a creative power embedded within antithesis. Conflict enriches existence. The negation is constructive. The contradiction deepens and expands the ultimate destiny of both man and the world. Whew, that was a long sentence with a lot packed into it. Let's unpack part of it. Heraclitus was the 5th, 6th century BCE Greek philosopher who said, the most famously said, you can never step into the same river twice, meaning that everything's always in motion. There's no stasis. everything is always in motion, everything is always in flux. He said, I mean, I think the actual quote is something like, that nothing endures but change. Nothing endures but change, and that everything is always in flux, and tension is the source of creativity. He says, opposition brings concord. Out of discord comes harmony, says Heraclitus. All of these things, you know, when I first read Halachic Man in high school, I had a little notebook that I'd have to go and look things up in and write down definitions like ontology, you know, which is that word on the first page that usually turns everyone else off. Turns everyone off, like when you get to that and you don't make it past the word ontology. But today it's so easy because you can, I mean, what we need is a hypertext version of Halachic Man where you just click on the word and it brings you to the link. But absent that, there's so many wonderful resources for anybody that wants to do philosophical study. There you go. Binakana puts right there is Heraclitus on the from the Wikipedia. The Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. Some wonderful resources are all available online, and any one of these topics is eminently accessible to anyone who need not have access to a university library anymore, or even a print dictionary, in order to you know, fill in the holes in your education. And if one were merely to follow up the references in reading this relatively short essay, you would get a whole undergraduate, if not graduate, course worth on introduction to Western philosophy. So that alone would be an interesting syllabus to follow, just looking these things up. Hegel, similarly, again, another very important German philosopher, put forth the idea of thesis, antithesis, synthesis. Science, religion, halakha. That the tension between two discordant forces can be resolved between the thesis and the antithesis with synthesis, with the part which is greater than the sum of the whole and which resolves the tension. This idea, the creative power embedded with antithesis, footnote 4. Now you turn to the notes. Let me turn to the notes. And you see footnote 4. There's footnote 4. Footnote 4 starts here. It runs on to here. It runs on to here. It goes here on to the next page. Footnote 4, the famous footnote 4 in Halachic Man, is almost a freestanding essay. I'm not going to go through this because I've twice recently done so here in the context of Web Yeshiva, including in that introductory lecture to The Lonely Man of Faith, where I kind of gave an overview to the Rav's biography and philosophy. I'm not going to repeat that. It would take us a whole hour to go through footnote 4, and many of you have gone through it with me. But I direct you to those links for people that do want to do it. But you're easily able to make your way through it on your own. In brief, he puts forth the idea, the counterthesis, the critique of American religion. Now, by American religion, I principally mean American Protestantism in mid-20th century America, but to whatever degree Judaism in the 1940s had been influenced by American Protestantism and the American notion of the role and place and function of religion, and to whatever degree the Judaism that was influenced by that were the Reform movement, the conservative movement, and to a certain degree, parts of Orthodoxy as well, it is a critique of American religion. the idea that religion solves all your problems is a mistake. Religion is not a panacea. Religion is not even some kind of easy, functional, utilitarian device that gives you peace of mind. The family that prays together, stays together, was that slogan that houses of worship try to use to fill their pews, and those empty pews are now, of course, reflected in the Pew Report. The Rav says that's not the purpose of religion at all. That's not the purpose of religion at all. Religion is not meant to give you all the answers. Religion is meant to give you the questions that keep you up at night searching for answers. Now, that is not, I mean, he did not consult with a marketing firm before he put forth that idea, this little nugget in the philosophy of religion. It would not have been a very popular notion then, and presumably now no more so. But, he says, that is the essence of what halachic Judaism is about. Tension is nothing to be afraid of. And that's really one of his great legacies to us, that we have nothing to be afraid of. That the tension, that questions, that contradictions and conflicts, it can all be synthesized, it can all be resolved. We just have to await the Ketuv HaShlishi HaMachriya Beinehem, the third resolving verse that will help us understand Talmudically why the things that seem to be in conflict in our lives are surmountable, and that through the furnace of struggle and opposition and redeemed in the, can be redeemed the fires, the torments of the spiritual disarmament to a degree unmatched by conventional by universal homo religiosus. You know who the universal homo religiosus is? He's the character, he's the personality that's being critiqued in long footnote number 4. So if you haven't read footnote 4, take a look through it, take a read through it. I'll link to it again in the source materials, and you can also, of course, listen to that earlier talk where I go through much of it. Our aim, says the Rav, our aim in this essay is to penetrate deep into the structure of halachic man's consciousness and to determine the precise nature of this strange, singular being who reveals himself to the world from within his narrow, constricted arba amot, the 4 cubits of halacha. You know, that notion that the, well, I mean, it's a kind of Talmudic metaphor for the personal space in which the halacha lives. His hands soiled by the gritty reality of practical halacha. However, in order to fulfill the task we have set before us in this monograph, we must undertake a comparative study, a typological, a Sprangerian comparative study of the fundamental and distinctive features of the ontological outlooks of homo religiosus and cognitive man. And for the next 10, 11 pages, that's what he's going to do. This analysis of cognitive man and religious man, so we can understand those two characters in order to understand in what way halachic man is a larger and greater and synthesized form, superior form of typological character standing on the shoulders of those two. For only by gaining an insight into the differences and distinctions existing between these two outlooks will we be able to comprehend the nature of halachic man, the master of Talmudic dialectics. And here we go, part two. Now again, remember, the essay is divided into two larger sections and then subdivided into these shorter chapters. So this is chapter two of part one. How radically different is the approach of Homo religiosus to God's world from that of cognitive man? The distinction between Homo religiosus religious man and cognitive man, between religious man and scientific man, is most distinct in the difference for how they look at the world, the created world. When cognitive man observes and scrutinizes the great and exalted cosmos, it is with the intent of understanding and comprehending its features. Cognitive man's desire is to uncover the secret of the world and to unravel the problem of existence. When theoretical and scientific man peers into the cosmos, he is filled with one exceedingly powerful yearning, which is to search for clarity and understanding, for solutions and resolutions. And the ancients already looked at the stars and the planets and sought an explanation for the movement of these heavenly bodies. Cognitive man aims to solve the problems of cognition vis-a-vis reality and longs to disperse the clouds of mystery which hang darkly over the order of phenomena and events. Cognitive man does not tolerate any obscurity, any oblique illusions and undeciphered secrets in existence. He desires to establish fixed principles, to create laws and judgments, to negate the unforeseen and the incomprehensible, to understand the wondrous and the sudden in existence. Cognitive man establishes a cosmic order characterized by necessity and lawfulness. Any phenomena which cannot be subjected to the rule of law and principle is as if it doesn't exist. It's as if it doesn't exist. And therefore you understand again why Kant said there are certain things that philosophy cannot explain because they are not phenomena in the real world, in the concrete world. I'll skip ahead a bit, page 6. Here. However, no matter how diverse these various concepts of causality are, and that's what scientists, you know, were very occupied by, questions of causality, cause and effect, through observation of the world, you know, like the old legend of Newton looking at the apple falling, you know, which is something of above a mysa, but it perfectly captures how the scientific mind works. We all experience gravity because every day when you get out of bed, you hit the floor. We all understand that when the apple falls, it falls down and not up. But it takes a scientific mind like Newton to ask questions of causality. What forces are at work? Invisible forces. Invisible doesn't mean spiritual. Invisible forces are still physical forces, meaning they follow the rules of physics, of the physical nature of our universe that we live in. Questions of cause and effect are scientific causes. No matter how diverse these various concepts of causality are, they all reveal the basic tendency of cognitive man, the search for the ordered and fixed in existence. Cognitive man is profoundly engaged in rendering an accounting of the world and charts out for himself a structured plan of reality enclosed in borders of order and law, whose ultimate status cannot be denied. Cognition meaning thinking, reasoning. Cognition for him consists in discovering the secret, solving the riddle hidden very deep in reality, precisely through the cognition of the scientific order and pattern of the world. In a word, the active cognitive man is one of revelation and disclosure. Apples had been falling off of trees for millennia until one person comes along and reveals the hidden force at work in the physical universe. The planets and stars had been circling overhead since Bereshit Bara Elokim, or at least during that week. By looking at the world, it appears to us that we are standing still because we don't experience the earth as moving. It seems rather solid and stationary to us. And you can understand why it looked like everything in the heavens was moving around us while we were staying still. But through the act of revelation, and revelation here, the lowercase all, not revelation hitgalut, of God revealing himself to man, but revelation of gilui, of man's uncovering of how the universe works, along comes a Galileo, along comes a Copernicus, and turns the whole model on its head. On the other hand, the homo religiosus, the religious personality, acts differently than the cognitive man hereunto described. When he, the religious man, confronts God's world, when he gazes at the myriads of events and phenomena occurring in the cosmos, he does not desire to transform the secrets embedded in creation into simple equations that a mere tyro, that an amateur is capable of grasping. On the contrary, homo religiosus is intrigued by the mystery of existence. The scientist wants to explain it. The scientist wants to, I don't say this pejoratively, wants to be able to reduce it to formula. The homo religiosus, the religious man, the spiritual man, wants to bask in the mystery. You can understand, there was this video that I saw, I showed my kids, you know, of the Milky Way, where they set up these time-lapse cameras in certain places, you know, that are not yet completely polluted by light pollution and smog and other things. And, you know, you get a sense of what the night sky looked like in the ancient world, how magnificent it was. And you can understand why ancient man thought that the stars really controlled destiny, because it was such a powerful experience, something that we moderns don't experience quite as much. I think only once did I ever actually see the Milky Way, meaning looking up at the night sky, and this was on an overnight tule in the pitch dark on the night of a lunar eclipse. And you see the literally billions and billions and billions of stars. You can understand why it was an awe-inspiring sight, night after night after night. And why ancient man, mistaken as he was, thought that, you know, that was the dominion of the gods. That was those forces, those constellations were something that affected our lives on a day-to-day basis. The mysterium tremendum. On the contrary, homo religiosus is intrigued by the mystery of existence, the mysterium tremendum, and wants to emphasize that mystery. So whereas cognitive man is involved in the act of revealing, of gilui, of uncovering causes, homo religiosus wants to dwell within the mystery, doesn't want the mystery solved. He wants to revel in it. He gazes at that which is obscure without the intent of explaining it, and inquires into that which is concealed without the intent of receiving the reward of clear understanding. This idea, the mysterium tremendum, this phrase, which the Rav uses from time to time quite a bit, is a phrase that he borrows from, where is he? Rudolf Otto, another German, not so much a philosopher, but a theologian. He was a Lutheran theologian. He died in 1937. Otto wrote a very important book called, in German, Binachana, tell me if I got it right, Das Heilige. How was that? Yeah? All right. Das Heilige, 1917. In 1917, there were things going on in Germany. It wasn't like a year you could necessarily just sit around writing philosophy books. But the context of when it was written may actually be connected to some of the things he was thinking about. But in English, the book is called The Idea of the Holy. And it's a pretty essential text in the philosophy of religion. Anybody that was a religion major in college would have encountered this book, The Idea of the Holy, by Rudolf Otto. In this book, Otto coins a term called the numinous. You know, he takes a Greek word and makes a neologism out of it. The numinous means kind of like the power, the awesome power of God. And he uses this phrase, mysterium tremendum et fascinans, fascinans, the fearful and fascinating mystery, right? The idea that God, that the holy, that the encounter with God is this encounter with a mystery which is both captivating but also petrifying. It's fearful, but yet it fascinates us. We're almost like drawn to it, but yet have to maintain some distance from it. The idea of that God is a mystery, mysterium, that he's completely other, that we can't ever, like the Rambam already describes, like our ability to describe, well, the Rambam is really talking about Olam Haba, the world to come, but it's true also for our ability to understand, you know, God is like, and the metaphor he uses is a fish trying to imagine life on dry land. I think in a different context of our study of the Rambam a few years ago, I turned that metaphor around. It's not that a fish can't understand life on dry land, but we can't even imagine what it's like to be a fish. Because when we think of all those children's books where people are, you know, princes are turned into frogs. So when the prince is turned into a frog, he's not turned into a frog. He's merely a prince who's been turned into the form of a frog because he still knows that he's a prince. But don't you think that one of, like, the really essential things about experiencing frog kite is to not have any idea what in the world a prince is? That the entire ability to be conscious of being a frog is to not be able to imagine what it's like to be a person. So our very act of imagining what it's like to be a frog is inherently unfrog-like. So we can't ever really imagine what it's like to be anything other than what we are. Because our act of imagining what it's like to be that thing involves the consciousness that we are something else imagining to be that thing, and that probably sets us apart from what it's really like to be a frog. This is an interesting question in literature in general. Those of you that have been participating in my talks on Rabbi Nachman of Breslov and Agnon's writings, last week, a week ago, we talked about Rabbi Nachman's famous case of the prince who thought he was a turkey or a rooster, depending upon the translation of the story, and his return from that kind of madness under the table, and the question of, did he really think he was a rooster, or did he really think he was now a prince again when he had been healed, or did he think that he was still a rooster, but one who could put on pants and a shirt and sit at the table with the king, eating from the king's table. When Gregor Samsa wakes up in Kafka's story, The Metamorphosis, to think that he's a beetle or a bug or a vermin or whatever it is that he is, right? Is he still Gregor Samsa? So these questions of God being wholly other are reflected in these kinds of thought puzzles and surrealistic elements in literature and in Jewish stories such as the tales of Rabbi Nachman, that God is wholly other, that we can never really, and that otherness, that mystery is petrifying, is completely fills us with awe, with the numinous, the awe of his power. It's yet one which has this kind of attraction, this potent draw and appeal that draws us in. Let me just look at some of these comments. Right, so Peter, the idea of having a dream where you're a butterfly in a garden is not the same as imagining that you're a butterfly in a garden, because the consciousness that you've occupied the form of a butterfly is something that a butterfly presumably could not fathom. There's that children's book by the same author as the fellow who wrote the Shrek stories about a donkey who thinks he's a rock. But like, you can't think that you're a rock, because if you think that you're a rock, if you can transform yourself into a rock, it's a one-way street. Since a rock has no consciousness, you can't then unthink yourself. So once you would be able to turn yourself into a rock, if you truly were a rock, you would be a rock forever. But you wouldn't be able to be a rock who can then imagine or then turn himself back into a donkey or into a person. Because if you could do that, then you would not have been a stone, because stones don't have powers of imagination, and presumably donkeys don't have that kind of power of imagination either. So that's why these things are dreams. That's why these things are dreams and fantasies. But in reality, they bump up against. So when the Rav uses this phrase, the mysterium tremendum, this is what he's drawing on. Right? Religious man looks at the world and he sees the mysterium tremendum, the great awesome mystery of creation, the great awesome mystery of God, who reveals, conceals himself through creation. The dynamic relationship that exists between the subject knower and the object known expresses itself for homo religiosus not in the desire and ability of the subject to comprehend the object, but on the contrary, in accepting the fascinating eternal mystery that envelops the object. This is not to say that homo religiosus prefers the chaos and the void to the structured cosmos, or the structured cosmos as understood by the scientist, or that he would choose to undo the act of creation and introduce confusion into reality. Heaven forbid. Homo religiosus, like cognitive man, seeks the lawful and the ordered, the fixed and the necessary. But for the former, cognitive man, unlike the latter, homo religiosus, but for the former, homo religiosus, unlike the latter, cognitive man, the revelation of the law and the comprehension of the order of interconnectedness of existence only intensifies and deepens the question and the problem. For while cognitive man discharges his obligations by establishing the reign of a causal structure of lawfulness in nature, the scientist looks for cause, effect, for formulae, for the operation by which the physical world operates. On the other hand, homo religiosus is not satisfied with the perfection of the world under the dominion of the law. Homo religiosus isn't satisfied. You see the mystery. You look at the universe. You look at the stars at night, and you're not looking for an explanation for how gravity works. To him, the concept of lawfulness, here lawfulness not meaning halakha, lawfulness meaning the physical laws, the physical properties by which the universe works. The apple falls because of gravity. E equals mc squared. Those are the laws we're talking about. For him, for homo religiosus, the concept of lawfulness is in itself the deepest of mysteries. The idea that we can understand the world is itself a mystery. The Rav is not making value judgments here. Often, I find that in reading this, homo religiosus comes off looking worse than cognitive man. That is not at all the case. That is not at all the case. It could be that we moderns, we, whether you are personally an observant, a religious person yourself, is irrelevant here because these are pure categories. None of us is either one or the other. But we moderns who live after the scientific revolution, we moderns who have been schooled in scientific reasoning, are prejudiced against homo religiosus as presented here, this pure type. He comes across as being something of a, I don't know, something of a simpleton maybe, compared to the cognitive man. The Rav is not making value judgments here, and if you read it that way, it probably says something more about your own value judgments. The Rav is describing these two pure types. He's comparing them, but he's not weighing them one against the other. He's not pitching them one against the other. And it's important to remember that as we move along. It is time, I think, for us to end. Try to read ahead. I will send out some of these materials that I mentioned. And again, if you are taking it seriously, if you are reading along with us, do a little homework. Fill in your own gaps in your philosophical knowledge, your scientific knowledge. You can really get a great education as you move along, just looking up some of these things. If you discover anything of particular interest, I'm happy to find out and to learn from you and with you as you go along. I think Peter had made a comment. Peter makes a comment, Mysterium Tremendum used in alchemy as well. The numinous and autos sense, Newton was also an alchemist, the root of science. Interesting. I don't know all that much about alchemy. You can fill us in. Peter also makes a question about Wittgenstein, which I must confess takes me a little bit out of my out of my realm. So we'll have to look into that. To the best of my knowledge, the Rav himself was not holding by Wittgenstein. I'm not sure that he quotes him. Well, fans, I can't recall him quoting Wittgenstein, but it's possible. Okay, we will continue next week.